Don't know if you've ever tried putting up an old-fashioned tent in a gale. I mean, you know, it's not the kind of thing that anyone really enjoys doing, and unless you're competent, which I'm not, you know, it's just fraught with disaster. You don't actually have to have done it to picture the scene, do you? You know, there you are, the wind is howling, the rain is pouring down, everyone's in a bad mood before you start, and there's this wretched bit of canvas, and it really seems that the material's too flimsy to do any good, even if you could get it where it's meant to go, and getting it where it's meant to go is almost impossible. It's blowing all over the place. Whoever's at the other end of it, you know, husband, wife, children, mate, they never do the right thing, and you wonder if you're ever going to get the thing up. I mean, the wind is sort of inside the tent, blowing it everywhere. Can you get the pegs in? Well, as we turn back this morning to first century Crete, we find there's a gale blowing. It's what I've called the world in the church. And the world is the culture of the day. It's summed up in that outrageous verse, verse 12. You probably spotted it as Ed was reading. Even one of their own prophets has said, Cretans are always liars, evil brutes, lazy gluttons. I'm not sure you'd be allowed to say that today, would you? I mean, you'd be had up under the Race Relations Act. I mean, I guess Paul gets away with it by saying, look, it's what one of them said. At least he would have done if he hadn't added verse 13. Because the killer line, isn't it, is the beginning of that one. This testimony is true. And you feel as if you're stepping back into another world, don't you, until you start to think about it. Actually, it may be very outrageous, but also it's a description that's very familiar. Always liars. It's a culture where no one will trust anything a politician says. I mean, before you sign any contract, you check to see what the catch is in it. We're telling the truth. It's just not part of the way we react, from the dog ate my homework, miss, to the checks in the post. This week, Connie Huck stood down as the longest ever running Blue Peter female presenter. Only Johnny Noakes presented for longer than she did. And if you can remember John Noakes, then you're dated. And when they were interviewing her for her time there, they asked her, what was your worst moment? And she said, I suppose not surprisingly, Catgate. That Blue Peter competition where they faked the result about how they were going to name the cat. I mean, if Blue Peter is lying, who can you trust? Evil brutes. Interestingly, last night, Kirsty Young started out as the new Crime Watch presenter, and she was being interviewed about the program and asked about the appeal of it. And she said, it's a striking thing. She said, at the moment, crime statistics are going down, and yet newspapers are full of crimes. It's because, of course, some crime statistics are going up. UK youth-on-youth homicides have risen threefold in the last 5 years. And they're often quite frightening crimes we read about, aren't they? I was hearing, it was a couple of nights back, I think, of Brent Martin. Disabled man, learning difficulties, in a wheelchair, kicked to death by three men, aged 16, 17 and 21. And the whole incident began with a £5 bet they had with each other. Evil brutes? Yeah, maybe it's not that unfamiliar. Lazy gluttons. You only need the obesity statistics, don't you? 1 in 4 adults, 1 in 10 children, apparently. Yesterday, well, they unveiled the government obesity strategy. I mean, who would have ever imagined something like that a few years back? It may just be that kind of lazy gluttons. It may be more general greed without self-discipline. I guess in the money terms, that would be a lottery culture, wouldn't it? In fame terms, it would be, what would lazy gluttons be? They'd be celebrities without achievement. You know, people who are famous for being famous. I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. Our first century Crete and 21st century UK. We're not really that far apart after all. It's hard to totally deny that these are some of the marks of our culture today. Very familiar, really. And certainly as we read this chapter, they're very corrosive. And not just to the culture of the island, but to the religion of the island. The world had infected the church. The wind was inside the tent, if you like. And by church here, I mean the religious groups of the day. Cretans, if you remember, were there at the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 22. There seems to have been a strong Jewish presence on the island. So he speaks in verse 10 of the circumcision group, in verse 14 of Jewish myths and commands. And he describes these leaders in verse 10 again as mere talkers and deceivers. By verse 16, they're detestable, disobedient, unfit for doing anything good. In verse 11, no wonder they must be silenced. They are ruining whole households by teaching things they ought not to teach, and that for the sake of dishonest gain. Seems extraordinary to us, doesn't it? Rigid rules on the one hand and immorality on the other, but it's not unique and it's not new. Go back to the Middle Ages and the selling of indulgences, and it managed to combine ritual purity, dishonest gain, blatant immorality. Or come more up to date, where have the great financial scandals in Christian circles come from in recent years? Well, some of the most striking have come from the likes of American televangelists. For all their impressive talk of morality and so on, they can drink deep both of immorality and materialism. Yes, superficially, it's ethics, not theology. It's lifestyle that's the gale blowing through the church on Crete, just as it is blowing through the church for us today. They claim to know God, verse 16, but by their actions deny him. It's a godless religion, a religion that does not transform lives. See, you identify false teachers by what they say or by how they live. And if they're not living the truth, then listen very carefully to them, because sooner or later they will either change the truth to fit their lifestyles, or pray God they'll change their lifestyles to fit back with the truth. But sadly, too often it's the Bible that gets jettisoned for the convenience of keeping the lifestyle. And if you're thinking, as I speak, sex, 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 it may be better to face a bigger danger for us and think materialism, materialism, materialism. A life that fits all too easily into the culture of the day has probably lost touch with the reality of the living, transforming God. And if so, it won't be leading us towards eternal life, but eternal death. Yeah, the world in the church. But as you read the chapter, you realize that the apostle isn't daunted by that starting point. It's not a chapter full of despair. It's not producing grumpy old men or grumpy old women. No, he thinks it is possible to put up a tent in the gale. Or rather, to put up the church in that culture. So he reaches for the tent pegs, what I've called the church for the world. Now, we've only a time for a brief look here, but let me just give us two starting points as he tries to build the church in Crete, which is that kind of a culture. Firstly, he mentions its message. It's there in verse 1. You see, he speaks of the knowledge of the truth that leads to godliness. A truth that changes lives and leads to godly living. In contrast to what you discover in verse 16, people who are unfit for doing anything good. You see, here's a truth that changes lives. It leads to godliness even in that setting. And his mission is to make sure people come to a knowledge of that truth. It's not just an information fact, by the way. It's a relational word. He's longing that people are intimately acquainted with the truth that'll change lives. and lead to godliness. Met up with a friend of mine last night. We've been meeting a bit the last couple of years. When I first got to know him, although he'd had a Christian background, he'd spent the previous 10 years slipping away from it. It would have been a story of illegal drugs, dodgy money, sex, and so on. And then God laid his hand on him. And when we first met, he said to me, Hugh, I've started to read my Bible again. And I'm trying to read it every day now. He said, there are one or two books I still can't touch. I mean, books like Romans. And I kind of nodded at him because I kind of thought of lots of Christians I know who don't touch books like Romans. I just sort of said, you know, why do you find you can't read Romans? And he said, oh, Romans, he said, it's too powerful. I thought, well, I know lots of Christians who don't read Romans, but they never tell me it's because it's too powerful. I mean, too heavy, too boring, too complicated. It's too powerful, he said. We met a week later. We were having a cup of coffee and said to him in the end, I said, look, would you like to meet up and read the Bible together? He said, yeah, I'd love to do that. Where shall we start, he said. I said, Romans? He was up for it. We've been reading Romans for the last couple of years together. And, you know, it has been stunning to see God at work in his life. See this truth change attitudes. Money, sex, life's ambitions. I mean, when those things are being changed, something's going very deep, isn't it? A truth that leads to godliness. I was a 20-year-old student when I was converted. There had been no drugs in my life, at least other than sort of, Calpol and aspirin. No violence, no money, not much sex. My sins were subtler. Yeah, I want to say this truth changed me. It's given me a conscience. It's altered relationships. It's removed prejudices. It's taught me the beginnings of generosity. It's humbled me. I don't try to live the Christian life without getting and staying intimate with this truth. And don't study this truth just for the sake of it. Don't study it just to get information. Don't hide behind sort of theological technicalities as you do it. It's meant to lead to godliness. Well, if that's one starting point, the truth that leads to godliness, its message, the second tent peg that Paul puts in as he tries to build the church in this culture are its leaders. If you've ever played or watched rugby, you know that one of the key things in playing rugby is the timing of the pass. It's not just giving it, it's when you do it. You know, if you get the ball and you've got something big coming at you, you want to get rid of it. But the key thing is to draw the man before you slip the pass. But you've got to get the pass away, or the movement dies with you. Well, something of what's going on in Crete is a bit like that. The Apostle Paul, he's left. He's been taken out of the game, so to speak. And this letter gets the ball away to Titus. And as he does so, Paul tells Titus to slip it on down the line. So you see, look at verse 5. The reason I left you in Crete was that you might straighten out what was left unfinished and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. See how the ball's traveling? From the apostle to Titus. From Titus to these elders. From the elders, as you read on in the letter, down through to all the Christians in the island. And notice they're plural, by the way. I don't think the New Testament understands the one-man ministry, one person who does everything. Here's a team. And here, faced with a society in as big a mess as Crete is, the apostle confronts it, you notice, with the local church. I mean, take courage. You can put up a tent in a gale. You can put up a church in this culture. You can even take the church, God's people, to the workplace and show godliness there. Why? Well, because we have the gospel and it's the truth that leads to godliness. So we must appoint leaders who, well, model the godliness. That's what verses 6 to 8 tell us. and teach the truth. That's what verse 9 tells us. I mean, that's exactly who you need to have as leaders, isn't it? If the key thing is this truth that leads to godliness. So, you see, who do you appoint as elders, Titus, or overseers? The words are really two words for the same position here. Elders because they were mature in their faith, if not in years as well. Overseers because that was their responsibility to look over the people that God's entrusted to them. Well, verse 6, an elder must be blameless, he says. Which puts us all off to begin with, doesn't it? If we think that blameless means perfect and flawless, then none of us need apply because none of us will qualify. But it is not without blemish. It's more the sense of above reproach, in the sense of without public charge. What he's going to say about the children later on, whose children believe and are not open to the charge of being wild and disobedient. You know, it's not that they've never ever had a tantrum, stamped their foot, slammed the door, turned the music up. It's just that if you mention the child's name, we don't all think, wow, he's a wild thing. I mean, there's quite a gap between those two, isn't there? And that's what it's really saying here. The church leader mustn't be someone who, the moment you mention their name, we all think, not him. Because the church leader is more than a private appointment. The church is not a sect. It's God's beacon for the world. So the elders to model godliness in family life, verse 6, must be blameless, the husband of but one wife, a one-woman man, a one-wife husband. He is to model it in character in verses 7 and 8. You know, those very basic, obvious things, aren't there? Verse 7, since an overseer is entrusted with God's work, he must be blameless, not overbearing, not quick-tempered, not given to drunkenness, not violent, not pursuing dishonest gain. Rather, he must be hospitable, one who loves what's good, who's self-controlled, upright, holy, and disciplined. And you look at that and you're nodding because there's nothing wrong with any of them, is there? And you're sort of thinking, well, is this what we want for the overseers? I thought we'd want every Christian to be like this. And you're dead right. Well, why waste your ink saying it, Paul? Well, because we want the leaders to model it. And remember who you're choosing from. You're choosing from Cretans, who are always liars, evil brutes, and lazy gluttons. Hey, pull this off, it'd be remarkable. I love the story of the wise bishop at one of his big synod meetings, and some grumpy layman was complaining about how terrible the clergy were and had a list of faults as long as your arm. And when he finally finished his speech and sat down, the bishop looked at him and said, "Do you know, I agree with everything you say. And it's a real shame that clergy are like that. The one trouble we've got is that when it comes to choosing them, we only have the laity to pick from." In other words, hey, we're all starting here. Now, when you pick people who can model godliness, negatively and positively. They must model godliness, and they must teach the truth. That's verse 9. He must hold firmly to the trustworthy message as it's been taught. Yeah, because this is the message that leads to godliness, that'll build up others. So that he can always encourage others by sound, that is to say, healthy doctrine. You cannot lead God's people without a word-centered ministry. No, that's not quite true. You can lead them, but you won't lead them in healthy ways. Unless it's with a ministry where this book leads. And you must be able also to refute those who oppose it. You must both feed the sheep and fight the wolves. It's not enough to have an upbeat, winsome, gospel-affirming, nice person as a leader. They must be able to refute error as well. Because the overseer needs to be able to face those we've already looked at in verses 10 to 16. He's got to be able to refute those who oppose it. For verse 10, there are many rebellious people, mere talkers and deceivers around. It's true today as it was then. So when false teachers increase, our duty is simply to multiply good leaders. They're the tent pegs we've got to get in to put up a church in this gale. And our God's not given up on the world. He looks to call out his godly people, even from always lying evil brutes and lazy gluttons. And he looks to use them everywhere, from the home to the workplace. Now, what doing that looks like in practice, well, that, as they say, is for next week. Thanks for listening.